Find all the details of the 2014 program guide at the RN homepage.
And thanks for joining us for Life Matters this morning right here on RN. Natasha Mitchell with you. An absolutely fantastic week of interviews ahead, I have to tell you. Starting today with this vexed question. What does it mean to be psychologically resilient in warfare? We'll find out about how the US Army is drawing on the field of positive psychology to prime its personnel for combat. Should we attempt to mentally inoculate soldiers, in a sense, against the horrors of battle? What do you think about that? Also, if you think it's too late to reinvent yourself career-wise, Cleo Lynch's story will intrigue you. In midlife, with six children, a divorce prompted her to reinvent herself, and she found herself careering into the correction system. As an officer, I should point out, not an inmate. So, two extraordinary women in uniform on the program today. Stay with us. Well, binge drinking seems to have reached a bizarre new level with a social media phenomenon called Neck Nominate, or Neck and Nominate. I wonder if you've heard of this yet. Some have said it started in Australia, though there's some conjecture about that now, and it's certainly gone global via Facebook and YouTube. Neck Nominate is a drinking game where participants post a video of themselves binge drinking a mass of alcohol in a bizarre way, and I mean really bizarre, as you're about to hear, and then they nominate a friend to outdo them, and so it goes, and it's become quite viral. However, in the UK and Ireland, five deaths have now been attributed to this game. The fifth happened just this weekend with a 20-year-old from Nottingham in the UK. One man died after drinking a jug of wine, beer and spirits all mixed up together. Another drowned when he jumped into a river after drowning a pint. Now, Facebook is under some pressure here to shut down the game. But should it be their responsibility? Are they just a platform? And joining us to discuss this very question is writer and social media commentator Elmo Keep, joining us in our Ballarat studios. Welcome, Elmo.
Hello.
Hello. And Associate Professor Jane Burns is with us. She's CEO of Young and Well Cooperative Research Centre. Hi, Jane.
Hi, Natasha. How are you?
Very good indeed. Elmo, this is like a chain mail in a drinking game. I mean, how bizarre are some of the scenes that we're seeing posted on Facebook?
I mean, I have to say that I didn't know about this until it was brought to my attention. And then when I did, I have to say I did laugh at the young woman who rode the horse through the supermarket.
What does she do?
She rides a horse through the doors of a supermarket, and she takes the horse up and down the aisles of the supermarket. I think that's funny.
What's the point of what was she doing? This was part of the dare.
So it's a dare. You know, young people, they love doing dumb stuff, and that they're programmed in a sense to do dumb things, be attracted to doing dumb stuff, and Facebook is just the way that this message is getting between them. And they would find a way to communicate whether it was Facebook or not. So it's much more to do with the behaviours of young people than it is to do with Facebook or any other platform. And, you know, the media bringing attention to it is also part of the cycle that I think we should probably talk about.
Ah, very good point, I think. I was wondering about that myself this morning. Jane, some of the drinking scenarios have become pretty out there. I mean, yes, there's that dare delivered on the back of a horse in a shop by a woman, but you know, I saw footage of a guy suspended above a toilet bowl by his friends while he drank alcohol from the actual toilet bowl. Others have mixed the drinks with toothpaste and dog food and deer blood, reportedly. It's pretty gross.
It is pretty gross. I think, as Elmo's pointed out, I mean, Facebook's just the information highway, isn't it? These behaviours have been around forever, and I think back to university days, and you being an engineering girl, you'd probably have plenty of uni stories as well. Ours at Adelaide Uni was called Skullduggery, and it was all about one-upmanship and how you could actually be the best at doing something really dumb. And the fact that this is young men, and we know that this is true, young men take risks, and the more riskier it looks and the better it looks, the greater the risks they'll take.
This is just intrinsic to the experience of being a young guy. Is it only young guys doing it, though?
No, it's not. As far as I can see, there are young women doing it. But just to put it into context, and I was having a think about this last night, and we've just had another motor vehicle accident, five young people on our roads last night. And when you think about accident and emergency departments, there's 6.5 million presentations to public hospitals. 1 million of those are young men, 16 to 34, and one in three of them are alcohol related. And so, yes, we're seeing it on Facebook, but this is just intrinsic behaviour in our young male population. And culturally, we've got to start to shift the conversations about what that means.
How do we do that? I mean, what are you getting at there? Because that's intriguing too.
Look, I think, and again, you know, you think about Facebook, you think about social media. There's a young guy, Chris Rain, who started a whole movement called Hello Sunday Morning about let's cut down drinking culture. So let's take a 1 month or a 3 month pledge where we just give up alcohol and we invite our mates and we build a community around it. And he started really because he was working in media up in Queensland on binge drinking campaigns and then realising that he was going out Friday night and Saturday night and binge drinking. And so he sort of said to himself, well, hang on a minute, this just doesn't make any sense. And as a young guy, he took it upon himself to start up the movement. And the number of young people who sign up to that, and across the board, people who just say, actually, I'm going to take a break from alcohol, because culturally we need to start to think about, well, do I need alcohol to have a good time, or is this just a part of what our society expects of us?
Elmo, there's predictably been pressure on Facebook to close the game down. How do you read those calls?
I absolutely don't think that it is the responsibility of Facebook to be policing people's behaviour. And in this instance, they've released their viewpoint on it, which is that, you know, they can't stop people from behaving idiotically. And I think that that's their call. And we have to remember, and this is possibly a whole different conversation, but Facebook's a privately owned company and they make calls based on what's best for them. They're not beholden to anyone other than themselves. And for people to say your responsibility is to shut that down is sort of really sort of skirting the issue. And if it's not Facebook, kids will find they'll text each other. They'll talk about it over email. They'll talk about it face to face. It's nothing to do with how they get this information. And it's much more now the responsibility of people's teachers and parents to be talking to their kids, which it always has been. And I think that social media no doubt complicates that.
Well,
task.
It sure does. It makes it go global. It makes it go viral in a way that we would never have seen before.
Yeah, that's right. I
think and that text messages really aren't a comparison in some ways, because they're still your sort of your internal network. Well, maybe not. It could also go viral that way too.
Yeah, and I think, you know, the speed with which things sort of get around to people is definitely new. Like, we can't sort of sit back and say that that hasn't had an effect on people's behaviour, because I think that's untrue. But you can't sort of scapegoat Facebook for the way that young people, you know, if you're going to go out and take a dare where you drink a litre of straight spirits and other alcohol, like, that's a behaviour that you are going to engage in whether or not you get told to via Facebook or via however. And it's much more about, as we're talking about, our societal attitudes towards drinking among young people. And it's a much bigger and much more difficult conversation to have than to say Facebook should shut this down.
Well, even if we say, okay, they're only a platform, they're only a medium through which all this is happening, do they not have some responsibility for harmful content? And they have definitions around harmful content. They don't feel that NEC Nominate falls into its definition of harmful content. So what do they consider to be harmful?
That's right. Well, they, you know, if you look in the terms of use, they will explicitly say that behaviours that encourage self-harm are forbidden on the platform. And that's much more sort of their stance on, you know, pro-anorexia pages and pro-self-harm very explicitly, you know, cutting those kinds of behaviours that very also easily spread quickly through social media. So they've taken a stand on that and said that's not going to be acceptable on the platform. Other things, they have a hugely fluid, you know, relationship with what they think is acceptable and or not, which, you know, last year they allowed beheading videos on the front page of their website up until some, you know, there was an absolutely enormous and understandable outrage about that. And so it tends to be whatever is in their brand interest, whatever looks best for them. So, you know, it's conceivably the pressure could get such on this issue that they'll be like, right, okay, we're going to outlaw this. But they would not want to go down that way. They would not want to be censoring potentially.
But this could be construed as self-harm.
Yeah, it could be, but it doesn't meet their definitions, and that's what we're looking at. I mean, we have to remember this is a private company. Even though they have an enormous influence over people's behaviours, they are ultimately responsible to no one but themselves.
Elmo Keep is with us this morning. She's a writer and social media commentator, as is Associate Professor Jane Byrne, CEO of Young and Well Cooperative Research Centre. We're talking about this surreal social media phenomenon called Neck and Nominate. It's a drinking game that seems to have gone viral. Jane Burns, we're talking about 5 deaths in an apparently very short period of time attributed to this game. So it's not surprising that there have been calls for attempts to stop it, to stop this game altogether, to shut it down on Facebook.
Look, and I agree. I think when you're thinking about the consequences of the game, they're absolutely terrible. And yet, when we look at what happens in society, that's true as well. So is it Facebook's responsibility, or is there a way in which we can think of this as a social network, as a network, and push back and say, okay, how do we cut down this behaviour and the different ways to do it? Peer shaming is really good. We work with our young people to say, what does it mean to be safe and respectful online? And I think there's been some great examples. There was a South African young man who posted on Neck Nominate about how he was going to change the conversation. And he was talking about homelessness and violence prevention, and he went out and gave a homeless man a sandwich, and that went viral. Reach Foundation, which is Jim Steins' foundation, the Reach crew did exactly the same thing. They said, look, we're going to shift this phenomenon. We're not going to make it negative. We're going to make it about creating meaning and being altruistic. And they have some videos up about, you know, what it means to provide and go into a supermarket and say something nice to someone, or leaving a nice message in a letterbox. So while you could talk about Facebook and Facebook responsibility, I think ultimately there is the responsibility of the peer network. You know, are we accepting of this behaviour or not?
But the difficulty, Jane, is that the peer network's working in the opposite way in this game. And it sounds like, from what I've read about it, that if you don't accept a person's dare and their nomination of you, you then get flamed by a whole stack of people on Facebook and get abused. So in some sense, the compulsion to meet the dare is a big one.
Oh, look, and that's human nature. That is what young people are all about. It's about trying to fit in, be a part of a group, maintain your autonomy. And I suppose what we're saying is, how do we change that conversation from it being, you know, this is a part of who you are and what it means to be tough and cool and important, and say, actually, this is a really dumb thing. And in fact, so dumb, in fact, that it's risky. And we know from organisations like the National Drug and Alcohol Research Centre and Turning Point, you know, if you drink a litre of alcohol, you are not going to be fit and healthy. You're going to be really unwell and possibly end up in hospital, or worse still, end up dying. And so there's part of it that's education, but most of it is about how do you shut down these behaviours so that they're no longer just a part of accepted culture.
And therein lies the challenge. Elmo Keep, any thoughts? Because you have this intense understanding of the dynamics of social media and how you know, it works in some sense, the kind of trolling culture, the kind of peer pressure aspect of it, but also how people push back in social media spaces.
Yeah, that's right. And I think we have to be very careful to not sort of, you know, paint young people all with the same brush, or as if they're
absolutely
sort of passive sponges who can only accept messages, and so, you know, they'll be just directed to do something.
Exactly.
Because, you know, they're autonomous and they're smart and they make choices. And like we're talking about, they're able to push back and inform a discussion in the ways that they want to. But again, I think we really need to, like, this is sort of typifies a moral panic, really, what's going on here. The media is really driving this. And I'll be honest, I didn't know about this until I had to look it up. I'm not a teenager. I'm not a friend of a teenager. I'm not a parent. So this is not in my world. But if the media is going to bring attention to it, it has that kind of amplification effect where a whole lot of people who wouldn't have known about it now know about it. And I think we have to keep putting that discussion back to say, young people are smart. They can make choices that are good for them. They can talk to each other. And it isn't as difficult as it seems for them to sort of opt out and say, do you know what? This is really dumb. I want nothing to do with it. And I prefer if my friends didn't engage in this behaviour. And that's the message that they can be choosing to engage with. So I think we just have to sort of give them credit, as, you know, the horrible things that have happened as a result of this are thankfully in the minority, and we just have to continue to have a conversation with young people where we treat them with respect.
Yeah, and very good point about the media fueling this. I must say, I didn't know about it, but I've got colleagues who are parents of teenage children, and they are certainly finding out about it from their children and their children's friends. So it seems to be, kids are talking about it, it seems. Jane Burns, a final one for you. If parents or friends feel concerned about it, what might they do? You've suggested a few examples of conversations they might initiate, but any further ideas to round off the discussion?
Look, I think as Elmo said, young people are smart and they are savvy and they do make choices and good choices online. As a parent, the conversations need to start early, and they need to start early about how you might engage in a social network, but also what it might mean to go out to a party and drink alcohol, or what it might mean to be respectful in relationships and respectful of peers. So again, I think those conversations, you don't have them at the crisis point, you have them constantly. And really from the age of about 11 to 12, young people are starting to form choices and they do want to be autonomous and they do really look to their peers. And so if you start those conversations earlier, you can really have rock solid, strong conversations about what it means to be a really good young person and a good digital citizen. And I think, you know, as Elmo's alluded to, you know, 98% of young people are pretty savvy, smart and intelligent.
Yeah.
And then you've got a small proportion who do really dumb things. And that is what we tend to focus on, rather than those who are actually the exceptional young people in our community.
Yeah, no moral panic being perpetuated on Life Matters here this morning. Hey, Elmo, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, great. And Jane Burns as well, thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Jane is CEO of the Young and Well Cooperative Research Centre. Elmo Keep is a writer and social media commentator. You will often hear her on this network, analysing various aspects of the social media landscape. And love your thoughts on this one. Get in touch on our Facebook page, or you can email us from our website, abc.net.au/rn, and look for Life Matters. 02833 1430 is our listener feedback line. And in fact, you may have had a go at this yourself and have some views on this. Let me know. On RN, Natasha Mitchell with you for Life Matters this morning. Well, look, an absolute leader, recently retired from the US Army, she has spearheaded the teaching of psychological resilience to soldiers.
In the body sphere, did ancient Greeks see colours in the same way that we do? Like, what colour is Homer's wine dark sea?
Wine dark sea is one of the most hotly contested colour categories. There have been dozens and dozens of attempts, scholarly publications, trying to get their head around precisely what makes the sea wine dark.
Ways of seeing ancient and modern in the body sphere. This afternoon at 1 on RN.
It's something we don't discuss, the scars of war for those soldiers returning from combat in Iraq and Afghanistan. The external scars are often more obvious, aren't they? But those internal scars are harder to talk about, and they are insidious in their impact. Anxiety, anger, post-traumatic stress disorder, depression, divorce, in some cases, suicide. Well, the woman you're about to meet knows those traumas of war firsthand. As a Brigadier General and a surgeon, Rhonda Cornham retired from the US Army in 2012. She was most recently director of a program established by the US Army back in 2009, called their Comprehensive Soldier and Family Fitness Program. It's an interesting title. Curiously, it has its basis in the positive psychology movement. And it asks, can training soldiers in psychological resilience before active combat make a difference? And Rhonda joins us on Life Matters. Welcome to you.
Thank you very much. Good to be here.
Good to have you on the show. You've told this story many times, but it's important to this conversation. Take us back to that first Gulf War and to your own experiences in the early 90s. You were a flight surgeon in the US Army at the time. What did the job involve?
I was a flight surgeon for an attack helicopter battalion. So in general, you provide medical care for the pilots and air crew and the rest of the staff in the battalion. You also do whatever else, frankly, they need you to do. And so we did a fair number of accident investigations and were the first on the scene in several aircraft accidents and extracted people and took them, rendered aid and took them to medical facilities.
You were also part of that first generation of women in active frontline duty, and I guess all sorts of assumptions were made about women's capacity in combat environments at the time. How did you view that debate then and now?
Well, I viewed it the same. I thought it was a, kind of a silly debate. It was interesting. There were rules about women couldn't be assigned at units at that level, down to the battalion level. So when we were visited by dignitaries, I just went and hid in the motor pool so no one would notice.
Oh, is that so? I mean, still, you were a generation of trailblazers. Those women were trailblazers.
I think so.
We don't want to dredge over the coals in detail, but in February 1991, you were on a search and rescue mission to find a downed fighter pilot, and the helicopter you were in was shot down. What happened to you that day?
Well, we were flying. We were really feeling very optimistic. We were almost like a kilometer from this guy. He was on his radio. We knew we were that close. And unfortunately, the bad guys were right there as well. And just all of us, we got really close, and then the ground opened up, and they just really blew us out of the sky. I got shot in the helicopter as we were going down. And it was going to be an unsurvivable wreck. We were going so fast that there was really, I don't think, any chance of any survivors. And so I just thought, well, at least I'm dying doing something honorable instead of something stupid. And then splat, you know. And so when I came to and tried to move, I think I brought attention that I wasn't really dead. And so all of a sudden there were five guys with guns pointed at my head. And I said, well, I'm not dead. But clearly I was a prisoner of war. And so, you know, I got to tell you, that looks a lot better if your choice is dead.
Yeah, if you put it that way, I guess I'd agree.
And that's how I put it to myself.
Yeah. Did anyone else survive in that helicopter?
Turned out, two others of our 8-man crew did survive.
You were captured, though.
Yes, we were all three of us were captured. I mean, there was no choice. We were way into Iraq, and we crashed. And one other person was really badly injured, and as was I. And the other guy just miraculously didn't seem to have anything wrong with him.
What were the injuries for you?
Well, I got shot, which is what broke my right arm, and I broke my left arm probably. It kind of got torqued off. I was holding on to the frame of the aircraft, and when it hit and flipped, I didn't flip at the same rate. And I had a torn anterior cruciate ligament in my right knee, a few other lacerations, and one broken finger, and that's about it.
Nasty. Did you receive any modicum of care from your captors?
Well, not right away. Day three, I was taken someplace where they put splints on my arms, and they did take the bullet out of my back. And then about day five, I actually, by that time we had gone to Baghdad, and we were taken to the Rashid Military Hospital and the prison ward there, and they did put me to sleep and set my arms so they were kind of arm-shaped again.
A weird kind of combination, because what you remember of those 8 days is also a very torrid time of mistreatment, and much was made afterwards of your sexual abuse during those 8 days. So, and yet here they were fixing your body as well.
Well, I mean, sexual assault was not ubiquitous. It was one thing one guy did, and it's a crime, and it's the wrong thing to do, whether you're a soldier or a civilian. On the other hand, when in the hierarchy of bad things they can do to you as a prisoner, I just kind of looked at it as, well, it's not really excruciating, and it's not life-threatening, and it's not likely to keep me here longer. So it didn't really rise to the level of getting shot or having them hide me so that I wouldn't get repatriated.
Which you were.
Which I was, very gratefully. I felt very confident. One of the best things, I suppose, about my situation compared to maybe some previous conflicts was I had great confidence the Army was going to come get me and not let me languish there for years.
In the years, well, days, weeks, months, years since, how did you process what had happened to you? Because anyone listening to our conversation now would say, surely this left incredible scars with you.
Well, I think that is a product of our misguided media, because surely it didn't. I came back, and in fact, the Army personnel office says, and what do you want to do now? And I said, well, I want to do exactly what I said I wanted to do this year before I left. I want to go to Air Command and Staff College and get my year's worth of intermediate training, and then I want to go do surgery training. And that was exactly my plan before I left, and it's still my plan. So I spent most of the spring and summer getting surgery and doing rehabilitation, and then that's what I did.
How did you process what had happened to you?
I just looked at it as something that happened, and decided, like, I read a book when I was a kid, and the punchline was, the great men in history are those who can turn a disadvantage into an advantage. So I look at all negative things that happen. I try to find some way to get something good out of it. So what I got out of this was, all of a sudden, I had an opportunity to actually voice the thoughts, you know, like in terms of women's equality and gender equality and equal opportunity, that no one had ever really asked before. And so now that I was, you know, I had done as well as anybody as being a prisoner of war, that no longer seemed like a very cogent reason to prevent women from doing something.
And so it's interesting to me that you became the head of a program, the Comprehensive Soldier and Family Fitness Program. Later on, down the track, this kicked off in around 2009, I think.
Yep.
And this was a program really there to address what is a terrible legacy of trauma amongst those returning from war here in Australia and in the US, post-traumatic stress disorder, and all the things that I listed at the top of our conversation is a massive issue and an unspoken issue. So tell us how that came to be.
Well, it came to be because it's remarkable how much more people will listen to you once you're a general officer. But, you know, yes, I was in 2008, I was the Assistant Surgeon General, and I was going to a lot of meetings with the Surgeon General and the Chief of Staff of the Army, and we were hearing all the terrible statistics about post-traumatic stress disorder and suicide and depression and drug abuse and all these terrible things, and the Chief looked at me and said, Rhonda, we've got to do something different than just keep finding and treating more and more disease. And I said, yes, sir, we do. And I said, you know, we don't do anything else this way. We have a deliberate process to prepare people tactically and technically and physically for what we ask them to do. But we do not have a plan and a deliberate training program to prepare them psychologically. And that's what we need to do. And not that we think we can prevent all those negative sequela in everyone, but I felt very confident, and I think the data is pretty good, that if you're more psychologically robust, you are at less risk of those things.
Now, there's a lot there, and there's a lot to discuss in that. So this program was set up, and you took the advice of the founder himself of the positive psychology movement, Martin Seligman, a renowned psychologist. He's done work with Australian schools, building resilience based on the principles of positive psychology. What input did he have?
I looked at who could help with this, and I did find him as the number one most respected and most experienced person in the world on how to build resilience. And that's really what we needed. We needed to build the skills in people so they could bounce back from adversity without psychopathology. And so I got in my car and went up to UPenn. And we partnered with the University of Pennsylvania's Penn Resilience Program, and we adapted the program. You know, it was intended for schools, both the middle schools, high schools, and college. We adapted that program for soldiers. So we changed a lot of the vocabulary. We changed the examples used. But the skills are the same. The skills are really the same skills you learn in cognitive behavioral therapy, but they're used as health promotion and prevention as opposed to therapeutically.
Well, let's give some examples here of what the program involves with soldiers that are heading into combat.
Well, I think the first thing to realize is we don't do it as a pre-combat thing. That's the whole issue. You do this, and we start now in basic training, you do this so that they will be more likely to be successful with any challenge, whether it's going to college or taking the PT test or going to combat. We firmly believe that these are skills, these are life skills, these are not pre-combat skills.
Martin Seligman has attracted quite a lot of criticism from other psychologists who think it's rather crude that here he is applying his ideas from positive psychology and the value of cultivating positive emotion to building the capacity of soldiers to be part of the horror of war, to commit acts, I guess, that in civilian life would be considered abhorrent. It's about as far removed from the original ethos of positive psychology as it could be.
Well, as I said, we are building people who will be able to cope with whatever challenges they come to. I think it's very ingenuine of anyone to think we should try to make people more susceptible to the horrors of war. As a nation, we're sending people to war. So I think just like we have the world's best medical system and we have the world's now best prostheses, that we owe it to these people to make them have the opportunity to be as successful as they can be.
How does the approach that you've taken have soldiers rethink the sorts of traumas they're participating in or witnessing in a combat situation?
Well, we teach them often to look at the situation that happened and apply some thought. Is there anything else I could have done? So is it really my fault if something bad happens? And then if it isn't, I mean, if there really was nothing you could do, then you may still grieve, but you won't feel guilt or shame, which is certainly more destructive than, I mean, grief is a normal, healthy process. Shame and guilt are not so much. We teach them to look at the situation, and no matter how bad it is, to recognize that it's very likely not global. I mean, if it's 140 degrees and you're really uncomfortable, it doesn't mean you're going to be that way forever, and it doesn't mean there's nothing you can do to make yourself more comfortable. So we teach them that whatever bad situation, like me as a prisoner of war, this is not going to last forever. It could be worse. There are things I can do. I can change how I think about it. I don't need to sit here and feel sorry for myself. A, it won't help. And B, there's things I can do to make this better, and it won't last forever.
Rhonda Cornham is my guest this morning on Life Matters. She is a retired Brigadier General with the US Army. She headed up their comprehensive soldier and family fitness program, really focused on building the resilience of soldiers and armed forces professionals going into combat. Rhonda, don't you want soldiers to be, in a sense, fully present, fully cognizant of the hell of war as they are in it? Because if they aren't, there's a risk they might lose that connection with the humanity of the situation they're in. And from what you're saying, is there a risk that they will lose that connection?
I don't think there's any evidence that people somehow become unaware of the horrors of war if they are taught to think optimistically. I think, unfortunately, but if you just tell people to focus on the horrible parts, you will decrease their ability to think up a range of actions to be successful in whatever mission they're in. I mean, what I want people to concentrate on in the heat of the battle is being successful. Just like what I want people to concentrate on when we're in the operating room is having that be a successful operation. I don't want them to be thinking about everybody else that was mangled in some horrible car wreck. I want them to think about the person that they're operating on right then. Something you can do something about.
Is the quest here to reduce the incidence of post-traumatic stress disorder amongst returning veterans? Because certainly, and the stats are very difficult to get a grip on here, but some estimates are that 11 to 20% of veterans from the Iraq and Afghanistan wars are potentially candidates for post-traumatic stress disorder. Is that the ultimate goal?
The ultimate goal is to make people resilient. And I won't say that this is a quest to prevent some particular disease. It's not. This is not prevention in the sense this is health promotion. Now, there is no question that people who are less psychologically robust, and this was not our data, this was the Millennium Cohort study that was published, I believe, in 2009, shows that the people at the lower end of psychological fitness are 7 times more likely to get post-traumatic stress disorder. They're also more likely to get physical complaints, they're more likely to get depression, they're more likely to get everything. So if being at a low ebb of psychological fitness puts you at risk, then it seems to me obvious we need to be working on making people psychologically robust before we expose them to something.
From researchers that I've spoken to over the years, the risk profile for post-traumatic stress disorder, you know, what predisposes some rather than others to end up feeling perpetually traumatized by visceral traumas they've experienced firsthand, it's difficult to get a grip on. And I guess one concern people might have is people blame themselves for their post-traumatic stress disorder. So even with resilience training like this, if they do then go on to receive a diagnosis of post-traumatic stress disorder, is there a possibility that the stigma and the blame will be exacerbated?
I don't think that's very
likely.
That
somehow they're a failure.
Well, I don't think that's likely as long as you've done the training correctly. I mean, that's like telling, I don't think that our Olympic athletes think they're at fault if they get a stress fracture during competition. They've trained and trained and trained and trained, but sometimes bad things still happen. And everybody accepts that. But they have done everything they can do to decrease the risk of that. And people that think optimistically will also are much more likely to go get treatment because they will have the confidence that the treatment will work. So we do teach people to think optimistically, to think that you have some control. So if you go and you get treatment, it's more likely to be successful. Which one of the reasons people don't go for treatment is they don't think it's going to work. So I think actually we are probably making it more likely with this training that people who then subsequently need help will go get it.
What's your measure of success? And I really must ask also, how have people responded? How have military personnel responded to, I guess, talking about their psychological well-being?
Well, happily, we were surprised at how well it was adopted. And we started off, I mean, we brought in mostly combat arms to become trainers of this stuff. We didn't deploy an army of psychologists. We brought in, just like the Penn Resilience Program brought in teachers to deploy these skills to their students, we brought in mid-level supervisors, sergeants and lieutenants and captains to promulgate this across the force. But we brought in combat-hardened, multi-toured veterans to do this. And they recognized that they didn't have the capacity and the knowledge in how to impart psychological skills to their soldiers, and they wanted that. And when they saw how well it worked, they were really, by and large, very, very positive. I was happily surprised.
The ultimate measure is the long-term well-being of people returning from combat.
That is indeed the ultimate test, is it not?
And have you made any progress measuring that?
Well, we've started. You know, what you have to have a measurement of training, and you have to have then some measures of outcomes. But we have shown that people who get the training do improve in a number of psychological areas: adaptability, flexibility, optimistic thinking, good coping. They showed recently. You know, I'm no longer in the head of the program, but I keep abreast of exactly what they're doing. And they showed recently that the people who had the training did, when they came back from a deployment, they had lower rates of all psychological diagnoses, as well as a pretty significant decrease in the rate of substance abuse in their initial post-deployment assessments. So I would have to say that they are measuring and they are analyzing, and the early results are actually very positive.
Well, we'll track the results with much interest. And thank you so much for joining us on Life Matters this morning to tease this out. I know many families of armed force personnel will listen with great interest.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Rhonda Cornham there, a retired Brigadier General, surgeon, and former head of the US Army's Resilience and Wellbeing Program, as you heard. She's currently in Adelaide, in fact, as a guest of the South Australian Government and others to work on an ambitious-sounding project. It is to make that state a world leader in well-being. I'd like to find out more about that at some stage. And look, a heads up, I wanted to let you know about Big Ideas tonight here on RN, hosted by Paul Barclay, straight after RN Drive, a forum, a panel on post-traumatic stress. Paul will be joined by a former army officer, a police officer, and others who have much to say on the subject and the experience. It's 8:05 tonight here on RN. Tune in. And you are with RN. Natasha Mitchell on Life Matters with you this morning. Look up next, another woman who spent a great degree of time in her career in uniform too.
This afternoon on the Health Report, the cocktail party problem.
You know, we can go down and spend hours and hours down the club or the pub or the whatever, and we don't come back exhausted. Whereas someone with even mild hearing impairment can go to a restaurant with a lot of clatter and other talkers, and after an hour and a half, they're exhausted because of all the effort that they have to put into trying to work out what's going on.
Why, when we can go to the moon, can't we develop a good hearing aid? That's this afternoon at 5:30 here on RN.
They say a cat has 9 lives. It's rather a nice metaphor for the extraordinary twist my next guest's life took after a divorce in her late 40s, after 25 years of marriage and 6 children. A fairly fractured career path of part-time work to fit around parenting. Cleo Lynch was teetering on the edge of effectively midlife poverty, and she was panic-stricken, as you can understand. What she did next, though, few would put their hand up for, I suspect. Cleo went and trained as a prison and parole officer, well, a corrections officer more broadly. She later, though, went on to become a manager of the first community-based pre-release halfway house for female offenders and their children. That was a real innovation, as we'll hear, in New South Wales. She's now retired, but ever active, and she's written her story down in a little book called Careering into Corrections, From Housewife to Prisons Officer, Entering an Alien World Full of Unwritten Rules. She joins us in the studio. Hi, Cleo.
Hello, Natasha.
It's lovely to have you here.
Thank you. It's lovely to meet you.
Why on earth did you consider a career in corrections? I mean, it ended up becoming 16 years of your life.
Well, I guess I never really considered it. I guess I was struggling to put my life together, build myself back into some identity, and I needed, above all, to earn a living. Mm. And I found when I floated myself on the labour market that all those school committees I'd sat on and other welfare committees, person of status in the community, I was actually only worth about $15,000 a year, and I could see that that was a poverty trap.
Major wake-up call.
Major wake-up call, indeed. And I was doing a university degree in medieval English, which I didn't think would shoot me through the career path too well, so I just saw this advertisement. Now, of course, I did know about prisons in a way. I'd been a volunteer for the St Vincent de Paul and I'd visited Mulloa prison. But of course that was from a different reference point and that didn't actually inspire me. Mm. But and then I'd worked at Auburn District Hospital and we got quite a lot of inmates and staff from Silver Border Jail and Mulloa and a few experiences there. But the advertisement wouldn't go away, and it was paying $18,000 a year, so it was a bit...
It's up on 15K.
And you did get that touchy subject of penalty rates, and there was always overtime just about if you wanted it. So I didn't want to, but I felt
compelled.
Somehow it was predestined. I just
put your
had
hand
to do
up.
It. Yes.
So tell us what the training was like, because here, this sounds like an utter baptism of fire. You were taught how to do self-defence, how to quell a riot, how to use a gun.
Well, they tried to teach me all those things, Natasha. I dragged the chain, I think, a bit. I never seemed to fire the gun spot on at the target first go off, and I was never looking to quelling a riot at all. I was happy to let them do it, but we had to have the gas masks on and the CN gas. It was an absolute culture shock because this was a paramilitary world. Now, I had brothers in the Navy, my uncles were in the war, my grandfather fought in the war, the Army was the Army, the Navy was the Navy, but I didn't realise the culture that I found it extraordinary. I found it so remote from anything I'd ever envisaged, I have to say. So I struggled along and, you know, they passed me and gave me a certificate and
although
sent there me
was
off to
a
the
note,
jails.
There was a note on your file, I think, never to work in a jail with weapons.
Well, there was supposed to be a note, but when I put in for a secondment to go down to Long Bay to the therapeutic unit, there was a condition when they granted me the secondment that I would be called to work in any of the other jails on the complex, all of which except one, I think, carried weapons. I just thought I'd have to go sick or do something inventive, and I never took overtime in any of those jails.
Cleo, what was it like, if you can describe for us, that first day, those first hours and days, perhaps weeks, working inside?
Oh, it was a surreal journey, Natasha, really, and I don't even know if I'm the person that did it, actually. You look back and you think, that was another person who did that. I was naive. I was struggling with a whole lot of different things, my own emotions, the family law, the children, the degree, and I was always playing catch-up. I was, I think, looked after a little bit. I think people were kind to me. I was older, of course. But, you know, I found overall it was quite a supportive environment in the end. We were mostly women in that jail, women officers, I mean, of course, all women inmates. And somehow there was a bit of camaraderie. It was a tough jail, but I think you trained there and you know, you landed on your feet and just went on to other things.
Well, in fact, working in a women's prison was seen as second rate. Definitely. In fact, never work with women was the advice you got. So, yeah. So both women inmates and women officers copped a fair bit of flack at that time. This is in the kind of late 80s.
That's right, yes.
So what sort of flack did you cop? What sort of era was this for women working and living as inmates in prisons?
Well, I think it was like a little, as I've said in the book, a little enclave. The department just left to the women. It was allowed to muddle along its own way. We weren't allowed to get the latest uniforms or anything like that. We were told we had to use up the old uniforms. Only the people who went to Long Bay and the flash places of work got the latest uniforms. The women inmates too, I mean, the women in prison report, the first one had been done, it had been shelved, so there wasn't much interest in that either.
How were the inmates viewed?
Oh,
in a way that was different to male inmates, perhaps?
Well, definitely, the men always said never work with the women, something I think they should continue to say, I think, but they don't do it well. Never work with the women was their mantra, but, you know, the women act out differently. Women get attention differently. Unfortunately, women parole officers would say that too. Never work with the women. I don't want to go there. But women are different, and they don't bash people around. Well, some of them do, but generally they don't have the lineup of homemade weapons in women's jails that they show in male jails quite proudly. Women get attention by being histrionic, perhaps, persistent, childish, all those things. But ultimately, women are the custodial parents of children. Women will have to go out and take up those responsibilities. Women need to be managed with those issues in mind, and how to get them through to earn a living. They're usually financially disadvantaged. Their health is terrible by and large, you know. So,
and this was an era where the numbers of women in jail were really starting to increase, just at that time, kind of through the 90s, wasn't it? Where
yes.
drugs, because of drug offences, we saw an absolute increase in women going into jails
drugs
that we hadn't seen before.
And the changes to the bail sentencing, of course, that just shot the prison numbers up anyway. So, yes, there was a rise, and there was also, I understand, from statistics, a rise in violent offenders as well. Certainly mental illness, probably a rise, and probably being diagnosed more effectively. So we're getting some quite damaged people in as well. In Mullaway, you had the protection unit, which was where women who'd offended against children or women who were just frightened of being injured for some reason in jail, in the jail mainstream. So they were in a little tiny unit at that time. And really, they couldn't go anywhere unless they were escorted, and the rest of the jail had to be locked up.
So kind of a jail within a jail.
It was a jail within a jail, and they were dependent on any program, people having time to come down, education people and people like that coming down to that unit. So it was, the population was about 5%, I think, when I first set up the transitional centre. And then, of course, the populations generally rose and the male population burgeoned as well.
Mm-hmm.
I think a lot more interest was taken then because a new report had come out on women.
Cleo Lynch is my guest this morning on Life Matters, and she's written about the 16 years she spent, sort of as a second career really, in corrections as a prison officer. But I want to focus in the time that we have on so you did lots of things. You trained other officers. That was a rather torrid time for you. Yes. You became a parole officer and a probation officer, and you did lots of different things in the system and in different facilities. But then, ultimately, you managed to score a very interesting role. It was an innovation, but it was controversial, and that was as the manager of what's been described as, what you describe as, the first community-based pre-release centre for women and their children. How was that an innovation in the system in New South Wales at the time?
Well, it was set up in two houses in the community. They were still prisoners, so they were still bound by regulations and legislation. But didn't have the bars, locks, gates. Everyone thought this is going to fall down in a heap. I thought I would fall down in a heap, actually.
Well, totally different environment. The women found that too, didn't they?
The women were absolutely, when they'd come into the centre, many of them just wanted to go back to the jail. The traffic going along the road, the lack of structure. You see, institutionalisation is a big barrier to people re-socialising and reintegrating in the community. And people become very passive and very anxious about any change. It's all done. You mightn't like how it's done. You might whinge and complain, but it's all there, the muster, call, let go, lock in, you know, meal times. They all happen in an institution. So this was about responsibility and accountability. It was about extra freedom. That was the carrot. But then I had to put in place something to, let's say, motivate people.
It was scary. It was scary, which, you know, intuitively you'd think that it wouldn't be. But when you describe institutionalisation, well, that it becomes scary, that sort of freedom. So the other innovation was having children in the facility.
Yes, yeah.
The system, though, thought this was quite a controversial development all round, wasn't it? This facility, having children, although I understand that this happened in Fairlie Women's Prison towards the end there too, in Victoria.
Oh, Victoria has, of course, different jurisdiction. I went to a prison there where they even have conjugal visits at one of their prison. So, but we're a different jurisdiction. We'd had a mothers and babies program at Mullaba way back, I think, when I was a volunteer, but for reasons I don't know why, it just closed down. The mothers and children's program, again, was another innovation, this bipartisan parliamentary report. And there were two places set up. We got the first child, but there's a Jacaranda Cottages at Emu Plains, of course, was set up, but that's in a jail still. This was a big step, but it was a necessary step, Natasha. I mean, women were going to get custody of the children when they went out, most of them anyway, and if there was some kind of barrier to that, they probably wouldn't be allowed to have their children with them in jail anyway. So the minister opened up the program and it was launched to great community outrage at the time, but that died off, as it does, and you just get on. Yeah. Day by day.
How do you reflect, finally, on that phase of your career working in corrections and the contribution you made to setting up that whole approach, which represented a big shift?
Well, I think I was lucky. I felt privileged to be involved in it. It also gave me a life. I mean, I'm here talking to you. I live in a retirement village. I couldn't have done these things. So I reflect on it. There are many things I haven't put in the book, of course. But by and large, I think it was a positive move. I have no regrets about it at all. And I think, you know, it shows that you can take a step and you can make a career. It was a long jump from where I started to where I ended up. But hey, it's worked for me and I'm very positive about it.
Yeah, and it gave you financial resilience, which is something a point you make very strongly in the book in terms of other women who post-divorce are struggling with poverty, potential poverty even destitution, as we've heard on Radio National in terms of homelessness now. Oh, look, just a little window into a story that you tell more fully in this book. Cleo, thank you so much for joining us on Life Matters today.
Thank you, Natasha. Thanks very much.
terrific to meet you. Cleo Lynch has written her story, careering into corrections from housewife to prison officer, entering an alien world full of unwritten rules. And it's published by Sid Harter Publishers. We'll pop details on the Life Matters website. I want to cross now to Michael Cathcart, where the BAFTA Awards have produced an Australian result.
They have produced an Australian result, yes. Kate's won another prize, basically. So that's good. So the BAFTAs have just wound up in London. So we'll find out who's won in the British Film and Television Awards. And also, lots of views of rural Australia. It's Clint of the Overflow. We're going to talk about that because it's Banjo Patterson's 150th birthday today.
He's looking pretty good for his age.
He's scrubbed up well.
Great, Michael. That's Books and Arts Daily right after the news. Natasha Mitchell, looking forward to your company next on Life Matters, 10 a.m.
In the body sphere, did ancient Greeks see colours in the same way that we do? Like, what colour is Homer's wine dark sea?
Wine dark sea is one of the most hotly contested colour categories. There have been dozens and dozens of attempts, scholarly publications, trying to get their head around precisely what makes the sea wine dark.
Ways of seeing ancient and modern in the body sphere, online at the RN website.